The nation of Israel was given as they were about to enter the promised land. So they've come out of Egypt, they've been wandering around the desert for 40 years because they weren't brave enough to go into the promised land the first time, and they rebelled against God's command. And so they've got the second chance now. They're just about to enter the promised land, and God stops them and says, okay, this is how you're going to live when you go into the land. You're going to have a nation that's going to have these laws. Right, so that's the context we're in. I'll talk at the end about how we should interpret those laws for us, because obviously we're not the nation of Israel, and we don't have judges, we don't even have a king, we don't have priests, or do we? Or prophets? But we do have laws, of course. So those the things we're going to be looking at in about five chapters of Deuteronomy today. And so, the first part, in Deuteronomy chapter 16, 17, describes the two levels of government that Israel was to have. I'll read from chapter 16, verse 18 to 20. And this is kind of an introduction to this whole section, so it gives you kind of a feel for what this is about. You shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribe, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice. You shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. So the big picture is, God wants his land to be a land where justice is the rule. Right? Where there's nobody being ripped off, there's nobody being cheated, there's nobody evading taxes. And so this is the big picture of what all these laws are about. And of course he also wants people to worship him. Right? God wants people to have a relationship with him, and he specifies how that's going to work, and he says you can't worship me like people worship the local gods of Canaan, where they had idols and all types of practices like child sacrifice, which obviously wasn't in God's intention for his people. So what we find in chapter 16 and 17 of Deuteronomy is a description of these of the government structure in Deuteronomy. And the first one is this idea of appointing judges and officers in all your towns. So this is like a local council or something. Right? And these are the people who are responsible for maintaining justice in the land. And note that they were chosen by the people from the people. Right? It's kind of like a democratic type of system. You shall appoint for yourself the judges in all of the towns. So they were basically the heads of family groups, the heads of tribes. They were kind of, there was this structure of society which was common in the time, which of course we don't relate to so well today in Britain perhaps, but maybe people from other countries might relate to it a bit better. But this idea that the kind of head of a family is a respected person in society, and if it's a few generations of family that they're the head of, then they're more respected, right? So those were the local leaders. And then the second level of government is described in chapter 17. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, and between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in your court, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So you shall come to the Levitical priest, or the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. So the higher level of government was there just to deal with the difficult cases. So when it wasn't clear what to do, and if you think of, you probably remember passages in the Bible where that happens, where the two women are fighting over one baby, right, and they go to Solomon, the king, right, and they ask him for a judgment. So that type of thing of going to a higher appeal, of course we know that our legal system here has a similar type of thing. I'm sure Leslie could tell you all about it. I don't know. But, you know, you have courts, you have high courts and all those types of things, and Supreme, I don't know how many levels there are. But in the nation of Israel, this high court was not run by a judge who was a secular judge, as we would have. It was run by a priest. Right? So a religious leader, so somebody who was versed in God's law. Why is that? Well, God's law was the law of the land. Right? So obviously, you'd hope it was a spiritual person who respected God and was therefore careful to be fair and to judge according to God's law. So we see here the role of the courts was basically to establish and maintain justice in Israel. But part of the law was about how the people approach God. And so unlike our society, where you can choose whatever religion you want, in Israel the people were required to worship the one God. And so the judge's responsibility included making sure the people remained faithful to God. And this is quite for us today it's a strange thing to imagine a government enforcing Christianity, let's say. Let's just think of it in our terms. Right? But it's not all that strange if you look at history, because many governments do this today and have done it for centuries and millennia. So it's not entirely a new idea that governments enforce religion, but does it work? Who thinks it's a good idea for a government to enforce religion? No? Wouldn't you like a Christian government? Who would like a Christian government? Good question. What's the difference? Indeed, you couldn't become an American president without pretending to be Christian. Really?
Wouldn't have to show your face.
You wouldn't have to show your face. All right, so it's a good thing. What goes missing if you force everyone?
Free will.
Free will? Well, not really, because people still have their free will. Look at we have laws that tell people what they're supposed to do, and they still do something else, right? Have you ever noticed how people drive? Anything to do with the laws of the land? Right, so it's not free will really that goes missing, is it? Somebody else said?
The heart.
The heart. Right, that people might pay lip service to the law when somebody's watching, when they have to. Right, and I think we have all seen people doing that. I know in this country there's no point to do it really, there's no advantage by pretending to be Christian. Maybe you're a politician, it might help or something. In America it's kind of important. But in other countries, of course, if you're in Muslim countries, you won't get a good position, a good job without being Muslim. And I've talked to people who quite freely confess that they don't really believe anything, but you know, they pretend to be Muslim so that they can be a professor at a university. Otherwise, they wouldn't have a chance. They wouldn't get the job. So you understand what happens, right? You enforce a particular religion, then it doesn't actually change anyone's heart. Right? It just changes our external behaviour. Okay, so the law had very severe penalties for not worshipping God, for worshipping other gods, right, for idolatry. So in chapter 17, verse 5, there's basically a death penalty for anyone who worshipped idols. And my question is that too severe? Martin. Yes.
And the concept of national viewpoint, Arab rulers speak during Muslim time, they created a cult straight after Muslims went up to Mount Sinai here in the city. So it's probably instinctively of human nature to want to be
sorry?
That's for being illegal in time. So you punish God off. And it's more likely to be.
Okay. Yep.
What's your question?
I was asking whether the death penalty for idolatry is too severe. And, Jane, you want to...
Well, my view is that God regarded it as being a very serious event, which justifies some of the serious penalties. And it's something I learned, which I didn't know the voice of that course, the formation course, was just that in the Second Temple period, after they came back after the rebuilding of the temple, they obviously thought, okay, one thing we're going to clamp down on, and that is idolatry. And so when Jesus came, he didn't actually address the whole issue of idolatry, because it wasn't an issue. It's the one thing that they, you don't hear about it in the Gospels. He doesn't sort of criticize the Jews. He criticizes them for other things. He doesn't talk about idolatry. It doesn't seem to be pervasive in society. I think that was because they really thought we've got to get this straight. This is what the why. So that the Jews fell away from God was because of idolatry. So I think there's a reason why it's up there in the Ten Commandments and all the Third Commandments, because God regarded it as being new too.
I think what we need to do is look at the bigger picture of eternity. Right? What does the New Testament say? This you know with certainty, no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. So idolatry in the New Testament also has a death penalty, right? It's just not a physical one, right? So, in a sense, if a physical one deters people, it's not as bad as suffering God's punishment eternally. So, I think it's always good to put it into context. I'm not advocating a death penalty for anything, but it does, you know, we should kind of have a sober view of it, that actually God is a jealous God. And there is only one way to salvation, and it's not going to be through worshipping idols or choosing our own way to to approach God. There was also a death penalty for rejecting authority. Here's an interesting one. If you didn't listen to the leader who gave his verdict, so this verse here, in verse 9, it says they will declare to you the verdict in the case. It goes on to say that if you don't listen to that verdict, if you don't accept it, then you also will suffer the death penalty. And again, if that's too harsh, let's read Hebrews 10, that says, basically it quotes this passage and explains, you know, anyone who rejected the law back in those days died without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Right? How much worse do you think someone deserves to be punished who rejects Paul, the elder? Simon, the teacher? No, Jesus. Right? Anyone who rejects Jesus, right? Who tramples the Son of God under foot and so on. So, this is, again, something to sober us and remember that the bigger picture of, okay, there's a life on earth, but that's not what we're living for, right? We believe that life goes on beyond that. And we want to be with God in eternity, not just for a few years, a short time on this planet. Okay, so that was the judges, that was the kind of the government structure. And then later, there was to be a king. It's quite interesting how it came about. It goes on straight after the passage about the two levels of government. It talks about the king and the law that God kind of imposed for them. So it says, when you enter the land and you say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. Nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. When he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law. So, the big picture of the kingdom of Israel was that they were given a king as a concession because they rejected their real king, who was God. And if you read in 2 Samuel, you can, 1 Samuel, I think, you'll find the description of that and where it's specifically described that they've committed a sin by asking for a king. And of course the sin is pretty obvious here if you think about it. You say, I'll set a king over me like all the nations who are around me. Right? So I think this is something we all can struggle with, right? Do you want to be like the people around you? Right? Is it something that they have that you wouldn't mind having too? Right? A lot of the temptations we face are exactly things which are kind of thrown into our face by advertising and by kind of just the society that we've grown up in, right? The expectations of the type of lifestyle that we should lead or the type of possessions we should have or jobs or relationships or whatever, right? All of these things, right? Wanting to be like the nations, right? The nations in the New Testament, like the nations, Gentiles, same word as nations, right? People who weren't God's people. That's what it's talking about, of course. And so they wanted a sense of security. They wanted a strong leader, somebody who'd stand there and say, you know, I can give you directions. Right? I can tell you where to go. I can help you. I can lead you in your battles. That's what they wanted, somebody who would represent them. Now, what happened was, what's quite interesting here is that unlike any other nation of the time, this king had to be chosen by God, and he had to submit to God's law. Right? No king in any nation had to submit to any law. Right? The king was the law. He decided something, that was the law. He changed his mind the next day, decided something else, that was the new law. God said, it's not going to be like that. Your king is going to submit to my law. And he gave them a list of things, and it's interesting, the specific things, not too many horses, not too many wives, not too much wealth. If you've read the history of Solomon, of course, it's almost a commentary on this passage, right? Because it's exactly those things that he did. And I think it's been mentioned in that way, to highlight the fact that he totally ignored God's law. I mean, there's only 6 or 7 verses describing what the king has to do. Right, that's it in Deuteronomy on the whole of the books of Moses, right? There's nothing else telling the king what he has to do. And how should he know it? Well, when he sits on the throne, he shall write for himself a copy of this law, and he shall read it all the days of his life. Right? Again, here's the only place in the Bible where it says somebody should read the Bible every day. Right? It was the king of Israel. So he certainly should have known it. There's no excuse for not knowing what the law of the Lord was. And of course, the aim of it was for the king to have respect for God. Because it's very easy, if you have a lot of power, to get used to being the guy in charge, so you can tell people what to do and just forget that actually there's a law above you as well. And anyone who's in a position of responsibility probably knows that feeling, right? You know, that feeling of, I can get away with this. I'm in charge. So the point of the king not being able to multiply wives or horses or gold, right, not having too much of these things, was all about trust. Right? The horses were a symbol of power, right? That's what you had for fighting wars. So it'd give you a sense of security if you had lots of horses. Of course, the wives would have been pleasure, although having many wives, I'm not sure. Mark Twain, I think, in Huckleberry Finn, he talks about, I don't think, there's some kind of uneducated guy saying, I don't think Solomon really was wives. Anyone who took that many wives looked like, doesn't he know it would just cause trouble? And of course riches, again, something that a lot of us very easily put a security in, right? We want to make sure that we've got a good salary, a good pension, good savings, whatever, investments, whatever. The king was called to trust in God. How much more us, right? We need to trust in God, put our trust in God, not in anything else. And that's what this is about. I think what we can take home from the message to the king is that we need to trust God. We need to put our security that God provides for us. God gives us, right? God will fight for us. We don't need to fight our battles. Right? God looks after us. God will give us what we need. And so let's trust God and not look to the world, not want to be like the nations. So the next part of this law regards the priests. So the priests were all from the tribe of Levi. That was one of the 12 tribes of Israel. It says in chapter 18, the Levitical priests, the whole tribe of Levi, shall have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the Lord's offerings by fire and his portion. You shall give them the first fruits of your grain, your new wine and your oil, and the first shearing of your sheep. For the Lord your God has chosen him and his sons from all your tribes to stand and serve in the name of the Lord forever. So all of the other tribes of Israel, when they entered the promised land, basically they divided up the land and everyone got a piece of land. No matter who you were, every family, if you had a big family, you got a big piece of land, small family, a small piece of land. Everyone had enough. And you could farm that land and you'd have your animals, whatever, grow your crops. And everyone had then a means of supporting themselves. And that was, you couldn't give away this land, you couldn't lose it, it was always kept in your family. So God tried to ensure that everyone had what they needed, except for the priests, or the Levites. They had no land, right, because they had to rely especially on God, right, and the way they relied on God was through the offerings, through the gifts that the people brought, that people were supposed to bring a tithe. We talked about that 2 weeks ago, I think it was, in the previous lessons, where every third year the tithe was brought for the Levites, right, to support them, to meet their needs. But also, when the priests offered sacrifices, they would take a part of the sacrifice, and then the people offering the sacrifice would eat the rest of it. And so it was a bit of a party. Everyone joined in and ate well. The priests were provided for in this way, and their families, and all the people who served in the temple were looked after this way. So there was a central sanctuary. It's interesting that in Deuteronomy it doesn't say where this is, because this is all before they enter into the promised land. It hasn't been specified, and in fact it was in a few different places. It started off, the tabernacle was in Shiloh for a while, and then of course David built the temple in Jerusalem, and that became the central place. So where it talks about this central sanctuary or central place, we're talking about, I mean, for most of the history of Israel we're thinking of Jerusalem. So the priest's job was to perform sacrifices. So people brought the animals, the priest sacrificed them. The priest served, of course, in the temple. They taught God's law, and they advised about God's will, including some kind of interesting practices for making decisions by having two different stones, one which kind of said yes and one that said no, that they'd kind of pick out from random from their chest or something. It was something they had, a bag or something, I don't know exactly what it was. But they were the people who basically would answer questions that you had about how do we worship God, what are we supposed to do. And they were supported by the people. And I guess if you're in a position where you work for the church, let's say, then to some extent you're living by faith, because you don't know whether people are going to keep giving money. There have been times in our church in recent history when people didn't give much money. Of course, it can be very uncomfortable being in a position where you're being supported by the people you're serving. But your reliance has to be, of course, on God. Now, the reason, why do you think people were placed in that position? Right, obviously, well, I think it was to learn reliance on God. On the other side, of course, the reason why they weren't working, the reason why they weren't given fields, was that if you have a field, you have to plow it and harvest it. Right? If you have animals, you have to look after them. Right? So you wouldn't be able to devote yourself to the service in the temple or serving God, right? Teaching the law, whatever the priests or Levites were doing. We see the same principle many times in the New Testament, this idea that those who serve in the ministry should be freed up. Right? They shouldn't be burdened. Right? If they're serving God full time, they shouldn't be burdened by having to earn their keep as well. It's a good thing for us to support them by our gifts. Okay, so that's the priests. The next section talks about prophets. And interestingly, it talks mostly about false prophets. It doesn't say a whole lot about the role of a prophet. But it gives us some idea of what was happening in the nation of Israel, that there would be problems of people presuming to speak in the name of the Lord but not actually saying what God wanted them to say. So it starts off in chapter 18, verse 10, saying, "There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through the fire." So that's talking about a child sacrifice. "One who uses divination, one who practices witchcraft, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer." So, pretty basic stuff. No witchcraft. Probably most of us don't struggle with that type of thing. Doesn't seem so relevant. I think it gets more relevant later on. Verse 20, "But the prophet who speaks the word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. You may say in your heart, well, how will we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? And when a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not come about or come true, the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him. And he'd be afraid of him, or you should not fear him, it's like saying you should not respect him. You're not kind of, you don't need to listen to him. Okay, so the prophets were actually the primary leaders in Israel. They were the people who gave spiritual guidance, especially when Israel went off the track. Right? And the basic picture was the prophets' role was to listen to God, and the people's role was to listen to the prophets. Right? So God would speak through the prophets to the people. That's what they asked for. Right? God spoke from the clouds and they said, "Oh, don't do that anymore. That's too scary. Please, get Moses to go and listen, and Moses can tell us because we can handle that." Right? That was what they asked for, and God said, "Okay, that's fine. I'll give you a mediator." So the prophets had a very important role, and of course, when you've got an important role like that of communicating God's will to people, there's a potential that things can go wrong, right? Because if it's my job to tell you God's will, and I tell you something else, right, you might go astray yourselves. So there are two ways that it's mentioned here that people could be led astray. One would be to turn to false gods, right, to the occult or omens. And that, I think, it's not too hard to recognise. If I said, let's all worship Baal, or let's all worship some Hindu god, I don't think you'd listen to me, right? You'd be going, "There's something wrong with that guy. I'm not sure why he's teaching." Right? That's the easy part. But the second part, speaking lies in God's name, this one's not so easy to tell, right? How would you recognise it? Yep. So reading the Word of God yourself and knowing what it says, obviously you can test it.
Mm-hmm.
Outcome of people's lives, Jesus said that, by their fruits you shall know them.
Right? The outcome is true, of course.
The outcome of what they say, I mean, this is interesting, you know, it sounds so simple, you know, well, if they prophesy something's going to happen, it doesn't happen. Like, well, they're obviously a false prophet. Feel free to phone them. The problem is, right, that's good in theory, but let's look at what they prophesied. Right? Jeremiah said, in 70 years, Daniel prophesied in 490 years. Right? So it's not actually so easy for them to recognise false prophets. What about for us, right? 70 years later, we saw what Israel came back to their land. Oh, maybe Jeremiah really is a prophet. Maybe the book of Jeremiah belongs in the Bible. Right? So it kind of helps us to recognise, and Daniel as well, the same thing, that these prophecies which have been fulfilled, right, that's a sign that they really are from God. But it's an interesting question. I think it's something that's very practical for us, because there are many people who speak in God's name in some way or another. There are many preachers and people who claim to be inspired by God. People who claim to just preach from the Bible. Right? Just say what the Bible says. But they all say different things, right? And so it's a real challenge for us to sort out the truth from false teachings. But it's something we need to do, and we need to be aware of that, and not just outside our church. I'm not just saying don't listen to any other preachers apart from the people who stand here, because Paul makes sure that nobody who doesn't know what they're saying stands here. It's not that. The Bible says we should test everything, right? Test everyone who gets up and speaks. Like, don't just listen to what I say, right? Go home, read the Bible, check it out, see whether it really is what Deuteronomy is teaching. See what, see if the way I'm interpreting how it applies to us today, see if that really is what the New Testament teaches. Right, so going on to the judicial laws. So the last three chapters we're looking at tonight talk about some of the laws for the nation of Israel. So we've looked at kind of the people who were in various positions, the king, priest, prophet, judges, And now in chapter 19, it goes on and talks about cities of refuge, as they're called. You shall set aside three cities for yourself in the midst of the land which the Lord your God gives you to possess. You shall prepare the roads for yourselves and divide into three parts the territory of your land which the Lord your God will give you as a possession, so that any manslayer may flee there. Right, now this sounds a bit obscure perhaps. The story is this, that if you killed someone, one of their relatives would come and kill you. That was kind of how the society worked in those days. It was almost the relative's responsibility. I think some countries they still do this type of thing. Right? Here, we don't tend to do that type of thing, but you read the newspapers and see what happens when somebody gets murdered. What does the family say? They want to see someone come to justice, right? They won't do it themselves, but they want to see the judge do it. Right? So it hasn't changed a whole lot. So in those days, because the legal structure wasn't so well organised and rigorous as we are here, perhaps, people were just taking it into their own hands, right? Didn't you kill my brother? Right. And that was it, right? And chapter 19 goes and talks about this in quite detail. It says, well, what happens if you go into the forest and, you know, you're chopping down a tree with one of your mates and the head flies off the axe and takes off your mate's head, right? Nobody saw it, right? And says, well, so what you do is you flee to the city where you'll be protected, right? And somebody sent an email recently that said, what a strange idea. Never heard of this type of thing. But actually, we have the same thing today. Where does Mr. Assange, how's his name pronounced? I don't know. The Ecuadorian embassy is the city of refuge, right? To protect you from the avenger of blood. We have diplomatic immunity, right? This idea that you can go somewhere and be protected. Right? It's a slightly different situation, of course. But it's the idea that there's a safe place that you can go until you can get justice. Right? Or maybe not, I don't know, whatever the case is. International law is very complex. What we see in these chapters is that the whole community of Israel had responsibility to deal with criminals and to ensure that justice was done. So on one side, to make sure that somebody committed a crime would be punished, but on the other side, to make sure that people who are innocent would not be punished or their life taken or being maimed or whatever because of some accident that occurs. So we see here that the law was very much about the intention. It talks about kind of, you know, if somebody hated someone beforehand, then probably they did kill them, but if they, you know, if they've just gone off to the forest to chop down trees together, then it's probably an accident, and you can assume that they're innocent. Nobody could be put to death without more than one witness. So this was another way of protecting innocent people, that even if, you know, if I said, well, I saw Tuka, I saw you do this, if I was the only person who saw it, that wasn't enough to get Tuka convicted. You'd have to have two independent people saying, yeah, we both saw that. Right, so it was a way of protecting it from a malicious person, right? I got it in for, right, I want to kill him, but I know if I kill him, I'll get killed, so what I'll do is I'll say that he killed somebody else, and then he'll get killed by the police, right? So to protect that and stop that from happening, they required multiple witnesses. Now we see this in the New Testament, Matthew 18, of course, it talks about, you know, if somebody doesn't listen to you, take somebody else with you, this idea of independent witnesses. Also, if you've got an accusation against an elder, it's not going to be listened to unless there's more than one person, right? And so that's a concept that I think still holds today, that we shouldn't just listen to what one person says, make sure you hear both sides of the story and see if there's independent evidence. The very strict laws are explained in the sense of keeping the land free of the contamination of innocent blood, the language that's used, or sin, I guess, is in more general terms. And so if there was a deliberate crime, there was no mercy shown. And the point of this was partly to deter people from doing, from following their example. So if one person gets away with something, other people will do it. If one person gets punished for doing something, other people will be scared of doing the same thing. Right? So a serious punishment can deter that type of sin from spreading. But there's also the sense of justice. If you remember when Cain killed Abel, what does the Bible say? That his blood cries out to me from the ground, or some language like that, right? The sense of the innocent blood kind of cries out to God for justice. Right? Because God is just. And so so there's always a penalty for sin. And there's a case here where it talks about murder where they can't find the murderer. Right? There's no witnesses, nobody knows. First they have to kind of do a thorough investigation, make sure that the people living around the area didn't see anything, they don't know anything. The elders of the nearest town then have to come and kind of symbolically wash their hands and say, we didn't do this, we don't know who did it. And they sacrifice, or they killed an animal, an innocent animal, as a substitute to kind of cover this innocent blood that was shed. So the last part of laws are in chapter 20, which talks about military laws. When you go to war against your enemies, and you see horses and chariots and army greater than yours, do not be afraid of them. Because the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, will be with you. The priest shall come forward and address the army. He shall say, do not be faint-hearted or afraid. Do not be terrified or give way to panic before them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies. So here we have laws for fighting wars, which are very different to the laws in the chapter before and after, which talk about murder. It's a very specific case because it's a battle which is God's battle, very specifically, God will be fighting. It's led by the priests, and it's conducted in faith. In what type of faith? God is with us, so let's go and kill some foreigners? No, it's God has promised us this land, so let's go and take the land which God has promised us. And interestingly, anyone who is distracted by having recently married or recently bought a house or something else, or anyone who is fearful, was sent home. Right? They didn't want them in the army. Right? We'll just take the people who are faithful, right, who trust that God will give them victory. And the law basically outlines two different types of warfare. One for when they're fighting against people who are from outside the promised land, in which case they would offer terms of peace. These terms of peace were that the people had to surrender and work as forced labourers. But in the promised land, God was very specific that the people should be annihilated. This, of course, has some kind of ethical problems. I think it's quite difficult for us today to understand this, I think, if you've got a conscience and think kind of it's not very good to go to killing innocent people. And three reasons are given in the book of Deuteronomy. One is that they wouldn't lead Israel astray. And that by itself is not a very good reason. It's like, I'm going to kill you so you don't lead me astray. And I take responsibility for myself. But God's looking at them and saying, look, this is what's going to happen. Because they didn't wipe out the people. They did go astray and follow the gods and worship the gods of the people. So God's saying this is, important. But it's also God's judgment. It's interesting that it's the only case, maybe in the Bible, where God's people carry out God's judgment for him. Right? Often it's foreign kings come and carry out God's judgment on God's people or something. But usually we're not called to carry out God's judgment. In fact, what does the Bible say? Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. It says, don't carry out vengeance when somebody wrongs you. Leave it to God. That's the New Testament teaching. But in this specific case, the people of Israel were called to carry out God's judgment on the people who had no interest in God or his ways. And the third reason is that God is fulfilling a promise that he made to Abraham back several hundred years earlier in Genesis chapter 12. Okay, so very quickly, how does this all relate to us today? We've looked at these laws which are 3,500 years old for a nation which we're not part of, and the covenant which we're not part of. We have to think about, are we just going to apply it to ourselves and just say this is what we have to do too, or, well, should we lobby our government for Christian laws? It's an interesting question, right? Because in some sense you think, well, it would be good if we had some more standards in the country. But fundamentally, the church is not a nation or a political organisation. I think as individuals we can get involved in whatever movement we want to, but as a church it's not our role to tell the government what to do, right? Because the government's a secular organisation. Right? We're called to submit to the government, that's what the Bible teaches us. So this idea of separation of church and state, I think that's something that that went missing around the time of Constantine, that was the 4th century, and continued to go missing for the whole of basically until now. There's still a lot of confusion inside. I mean, the Reformation didn't solve the problem, it just went from the Roman Catholic Church killing people for disagreeing with them to the Protestant Church killing people for disagreeing with them. It didn't help the situation. But they, you know, they had this Old Testament view, this view, like in Deuteronomy, that, you know, we're here to ensure that God's law is kept, so anyone who doesn't keep it, we can do whatever we like to them. And that's not, I think, what we're called to do. So there's lots of lessons from history that we can learn. It's very tragic to read church history over the, you know, the 2,000 years of it, and see what's gone wrong. As a result of people misunderstanding, I think, and misapplying this type of thing and trying to apply an old system to us under the new covenant. There's also a question of holy war. How does this relate to us? Because you hear some really interesting language used by politicians to justify invading other countries and taking control of their reserves of oil and things. That's the most interesting things for most governments. Basically, in the New Testament, Jesus teaches us to love our enemies, which is quite different to when you go to war against your enemies, which is how chapter 20 of Deuteronomy starts. Right? Jesus says, love your enemies. Paul writes, we don't wage war as the world does. Our weapons are not the weapons of the world. Right? Doesn't mean we don't have weapons. There's a fair bit of military language in the Bible, in the New Testament. But it talks about a spiritual war. It says, look, the war that we fight is a spiritual war. The weapons we have are the word of God, right? The sword of the spirit and so on. So the language of war still applies, but it's not physical war. We shouldn't be going out fighting people physically, but we're fighting a spiritual battle to win souls for Jesus. So Jesus calls us to wait for justice, not to take vengeance ourselves, to trust that God will give us justice in the end. That means after you die, right? Get used to the idea. Right? You might get justice sometimes in your life on earth, but if you don't feel that God has let you down. Right? That's important, right? You can easily feel that I'm being ripped off, I'm being mistreated here. It's like, well, maybe. But this life is just a short time. Right? We're looking for something, we're looking forward to something a lot further on than just this life. So the issue is trust, right? Can you trust God? Right? We're called to live in faith and that's what we should be doing. So just to give you a taste of something I'm going to do in a few weeks' time, for the last lesson on Deuteronomy, is I'd like to just give you a thought of what Deuteronomy is really about, from my point of view, and I hope you agree with this. I think communities need some type of structure and organisation and leadership and all that type of thing. And we're a community. So who fills these roles today? Right, how does this work for us? How does this apply to us? See, Moses actually promised there would be another prophet who would take his place. And if you look in Deuteronomy 18, he talks about that. What about a king? Behold, your king comes to you riding on a colt, right? So we have a king, right? We have to recognise it. Who's your priest? Well, if you remember the lessons from Hebrews last year, we have a great high priest. The same person as our king. Who's the prophet? The prophet that Moses promised. Somebody will come, like me. You better listen to him. It's the same person again. Right? And even things like the city of refuge, who do you go to when you're accused? But all of these things are actually pointing towards Jesus. Right? All of these needs of the community should point us towards Jesus, that we recognise these needs in our own life and we look to Jesus to fulfil them. And of course, when it talks about all the sacrifices, of course, who paid the penalty for our sins? Who, for the innocent blood that was shed, right, for all of the things that we've done wrong, that deserve being punished. Of course, Jesus took that upon himself. And so I'd like to finish with that thought, that actually a lot of this is pointing towards Jesus. And if we really want to read the Old Testament and understand it, how it applies to us today, we can't forget Jesus, right? Think about how it applies to Jesus. Think, this is really what the big picture is. Don't try to read too much into laws about how to, well, there's lots of laws in Deuteronomy, right? Laws about what to wear, whether you should wear clothes that aren't made out of pure cotton or something. No. Get the point, right? This is about Jesus.